Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. What do militant atheists have in common with religious fundamentalists? Despite worldviews that would seem to be polar opposites, comparative religion scholar Karen Armstrong points out that many fundamentalists and atheists profess equal degrees of certainty about exactly what God is or is not, and both are likely to focus on the role of belief over action in declaring a person to be religious. She joins us now to talk about her latest book, The Case for God. Karen, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
You write here that we have actually regressed in terms of the sophistication with which we think about God. What is different between modern and ancient concepts of God?
Well, in the pre-modern world, people in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all knew that it was very difficult indeed to speak about God. They said that we couldn't even really say that God existed, because our concept of existence is so limited that it cannot apply to something that goes beyond thought and speech, and that the best way that religious rituals and practices were designed to hold us in an attitude of awe and wonder, where we felt we'd come to the end of what words and speech can do. But then in the modern period, great scientific geniuses like Isaac Newton claimed that they'd found a scientific proof for God's existence, something that would have made Thomas Aquinas, for example, or Maimonides turn in their graves. And churchmen and theologians were intoxicated by this idea of absolute scientific certainty and reduced God to a fact. And that's made religion very difficult for a lot of people. Usually, you know, when we hear about God for the first time, when we're quite young, at the same time as we're learning about Santa Claus, and our ideas about Santa Claus change and develop in time, but we're not encouraged so much in our society to think, to let our ideas about God become more sophisticated.
What kind of stock did ancient peoples put in the fact behind their mythology?
Well, they knew that mythology wasn't about fact. There were two recognized ways in the ancient world of approaching truth, and the Greeks call these mythos, myth, and logos, science, reason. And we need reason when we're organizing our society or creating a scientific experiment or politics. We need reason, and an economic policy needs reason. Medicine needs reason. But myth is addressing those more elusive aspects of life, those for which there are no easy solutions, that help us to deal with the turbulence of our grief and dismay when we learn we've got cancer. Our doctors can help us to cure our cancer and they can diagnose the disease, but they can't help us to die well, kindly and compassionately. For that, people have turned to myth. And those stories of gods descending into labyrinths and heroes fighting monsters and demons were not intended to be factual. They've been described as an early form of psychology. They helped people to deal with their own labyrinthine, convoluted internal world and find meaning in the perplexing difficulties of life.
So how did the concept of God sort of coagulate into something in which many people in different faith traditions said, we know this is what's going on and this is how you should approach it and this is how you should act?
Not all religions, of course, take God as their symbol of this ultimate transcendence. I was with the Dalai Lama last weekend, and he doesn't see a creator God as important, but he is certainly imbued with transcendence. It really happened, especially in the Western Christian world. We started because under the influence of our scientific training, and training in rationality, we started to read our scriptures with a literalness that is unprecedented in the history of religion. And that's made it difficult. In the past, Jewish and Christian theologians both said that it was impossible to read these texts literally because they're very contradictory. And you have to work hard to find an inner spiritual meaning that will make these texts speak to your particular circumstances. And I have to say that growing up as a Catholic child, I was not taught to read the Bible literally. I was taught, our pastors and preachers and the nuns who taught me all encourage us to think allegorically. And indeed, St. Augustine, who is the can be regarded as the founder of Christianity, someone who is revered as a major authority by Catholics and Protestants alike, said that if a biblical text was found to contradict contemporary science, we had to find a new allegorical interpretation for that text. And Calvin said the same thing, right? He was a great devotee of St. Augustine, and right on the brink of the scientific revolution, he was saying in his commentary on the first chapter of Genesis, if you want to find out about astronomy or cosmology and the state of the universe, don't look to the Bible. The Bible's not telling us that. Look elsewhere.
So how did this embrace of Logos ultimately sort of backfire to the extent that it made it impossible for a lot of people to rectify things that they view through reason and things that they feel in the heart or in the spirit?
Well, part of the thing is that that for Newton and the other early scientists of our scientific era, God was essential to their physics. The Newton solar system didn't work without God. But a few generations down the road, other scientists found it very easy to find a natural explanation for the universe. But people had become so inured to Newton's God, which had been brought into the center of religious thinking in the Christian West by the evangelical in North America. In the first instance. And this made it very difficult for them to see that if God was not a fact, and if the scriptures were not scientifically or historically true, how could they be true at all? Because we'd lost the older mythical habits of thought. You see, in the past, people went to great lengths in their theology to realize that when we come to talk about God, we're in silence. We're at the end of what words and thoughts can do. There's a right in the 10th century before Christ, the people of India developed a ritual which I think is the model of authentic religious discourse. And the priests would go off into the forest and make a retreat, put themselves into a different frame of mind and come back for their competition, a sacred competition. And one of the challenger would try to define the Brahman, which is the ultimate reality, a reality that exists way beyond the gods, that is unspeakable. But he would try in his learned, poetic way to find a formula that expressed Brahman. And his opponents had to take that and then come back at him, improving on it. And the winner was the person who reduced everybody to silence. And in that silence, the Brahman was present. The Brahman was not present, was not experienced in all the wordy, convoluted discourse, but it was experienced in the stunning realization of the impotence of speech. And it's the same thing that poetry does for us. Or music. You know how it is that when you go to the symphony and there's a beat of silence very often as the last notes die away and before the applause begins. Well, theology at its best is helping you to live in that moment of silence.
Karen Armstrong is my guest. Her latest book is called The Case for God. You write that there is too much talking, especially in contemporary Christianity. And I think you've just spoken about the value of silence. But how did we get to this place where we talk so much and exist so little in silence?
Well, we are a very talkative society. This is a talk show.
God for that.
And our waves are sort of airways are clogged. We are taught, and in our democratic societies, thank goodness, to have our opinions, to express them. And we like to do that. But we're not very good at listening. And we've tended in our educations to so finely tune those rational reasoning powers, the logos powers, that we've neglected to cultivate these interior, mystical, mythical parts of ourselves, the more imaginative parts of ourselves, don't get quite the same amount of attention. I mean, the politicians are always saying, let's improve scientific teaching, teaching of mathematics, crucially important. But also important are the humanities, where you are endlessly discussing ideas for which there are no solutions. Philosophers are still talking about the things that Plato was discussing all those centuries ago, the nature of happiness. How do we deal with our mortality? How do we face the prospect of death? How do we endure the suffering that we see on all sides of us, in our world and with other people far away, in our own family, in our own hearts? And how do we live with that serenely, creatively, peacefully, in contact with a transcendent dimension which cannot be defined? We got so used to solving problems scientifically that we get frustrated if people say, well, what is God then? And as the author of The Cloud of Unknowing said to his 14th century mystical text, said to his pupil when he asked, well, what is God? And he said, I don't know. And we've lost the sense of the delight and joy that is to be found in unknowing. Einstein had it when he contemplated the indeterminate universe of quantum mechanics. He found it a source of profound joy and delight. He said, it's when we are in contact with that for which there are no solutions, which we cannot grasp, that we are living most fully. Karl Popper, the scientist and philosopher, also said the same. He said, the most important thing that we know is, I don't know. And he said, and that is a source of huge contentment. Socrates, the founder of the Western rational tradition, said that a dialogue was not meant to lead to one person finding the solution and beating his opponents. It was found when everybody, all participants in a dialogue, came to that point when they realized the limits of their knowledge, that they didn't know. And at that moment, when they realized the profound ignorance of the human condition, they could become philosophers. Mm-hmm. Now, we've become so opinionated, we're encouraged, quite rightly, to find solutions to problems in science. And that's what we do in science. In science, people find a problem, solve it, go on to the next one. But there are other problems for which we, each generation, each human being, has to grapple, for which there are no ready solutions. And religion has helped people to do that.
You know, it is interesting when you think about letting go of the need to define God. It also frees people, it would seem, from the fear that they're getting it wrong somehow.
Yes, or not believing things. Mm-hmm. You know, I grappled with that myself for a long time. Now, I don't want to undermine anybody's faith. If people find that the conventional idea of God as a personality that speaks to them and that they can speak to really works for them, that it gives them a sense of transcendence, and above all, and this is not my test, but the litmus test evolved in all the major traditions, Buddhism, Confucianism, Hinduism, is that all religion must lead to compassion, to open-hearted compassion for others. If your idea of God does that, it's done its job for you.
Karen Armstrong is my guest. Her new book is called The Case for God.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is religious scholar Karen Armstrong. Her new book is called The Case for God. Karen, how does the understanding of an ineffable God affect the way we would approach worshipping God?
Well, one of the things we've lost in the modern world is that we think, first of all, before we can even start to live a religious life and worship and practice ethical Christian teachings, we have to believe in God. Now, in the past, that would be putting the cart before the horse, as we say in England. I don't know whether you have that saying here.
Sure.
But first you practice. Religion, religious insight, and it's the same with the philosophical insight of Socrates, Plato and Aristotle, came not from abstract thinking or abstract discoveries, but from dedicated spiritual exercises and a disciplined lifestyle. Spiritual exercises that helped to put you in a different frame of mind, helped you to realize, and rituals that helped you to realize, oh, as a great piece of music does, how, a sense that touches you within, lifts you beyond yourselves. And above all, the disciplined exercise of compassion, the ability to feel with the other person, dethroning yourself from the center of your world, putting another there. This has been the chief way in which all the religious faiths, whether we're talking about Buddhism, Hinduism, Confucianism, Taoism, Judaism, Christianity and Islam, this is how we come to what we call God, Nirvana, Brahman, Tao, because it is the disciplined laying aside of egotism and selfishness and putting another person, as monotheists would say, in God's image, in the focus.
You know, there are many people who believe that without the fear of the wrath of God or without the desire to please God specifically according to a set of doctrinal tenets, that people won't be motivated to do these things, to be compassionate and to put other people in the center of their lives.
Well, you know, that's a rather infantile way, if I may say so, mm-hmm. way of approaching things. You know, that's what, you know, you tell children that you threaten them with God's wrath or with your wrath if they don't come into line. But you don't get that at all in the early rabbis in the Talmudic age, who wouldn't even listen to a voice from heaven if it boomed down and contradicted them. They said, no, not even a voice from heaven can tell us how to believe. The world religions say you must have a sort of confident, be a mature person and take yourself into your own hands. There's a story that after God heard that rabbi saying, no, I don't listen to a voice from heaven, the story goes on to say that God smiled and said, my children have defeated me. In other words, they've grown up. They're no longer just swallowing gullibly everything they're told, but they're thinking and functioning for themselves. The Buddhists would say that to take anything at all, any teaching at all, at second hand and on somebody else's say-so is an impediment to enlightenment because you're not fully engaged. We see no set of rules, no set of doctrines can encapsulate the whole of God. What God is lies beyond the reach of our clear concepts and definitions. The doctrines are telling us how to live compassionately. They're calls to action, like any great mythos. And you don't understand what they mean unless you put them into practice. They're like a religious doctrine that is not put into practice and translated into practical, compassionate action is rather like the rules of a board game, which seem very, very arcane and complicated and boring and impenetrable. And then you pick up the dice and start to play and everything falls into place. So if you don't do it, you don't get it. It's the other way on.
What's so interesting, I think, about that metaphor is the idea that when you're actually playing the game, what you're doing is interacting with other human beings.
And indeed, both, say, Confucius and Socrates said that we need other people in order to reach out to them, exercise compassion, discuss with them, and then we fulfill ourselves. It's, as Confucius would call it, it's co-humanity. We create an enhanced humanity filled with transcendence, living brimful of holiness by interaction with one another. And that's why compassion is important. It stresses that we do this together.
Karen Armstrong is my guest. Her new book is called The Case for God. Let's go to Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hello. This is an interesting subject that I've discussed in philosophy classes over the years. I'm interested in your view on the comparison between autochthonous religions that rise in a place, like the Native American religions here. They primarily taught people how to get along, how to hunt, how to maintain a stable, relatively stable food supply. It's my understanding that at one time in the Middle East, all of the, what I would refer to now as industrial religions that are now global, rose in the same way. And I'm wondering, they've escaped their localities. They've changed. They don't answer to a culture in a climate that needed direction. So I'm curious how you view smaller local religions with these much larger ones that displace local gods rather than accepting them in as part of a panoply.
Thank you. What a good question. What an interesting question. You see, religion does change. Our mythology does change. We know that the very earliest religions, before the invention of agriculture, centered on the notion of hunting and dealt with the difficulty that hunters still feel in some of the indigenous populations about killing other creatures. And they were taught to kill in a sacred manner, not just to go out as a ruthless killer, but to recognize their prey as sacred beings. And then the attention switches to Mother Earth when agriculture develops. Because if a religion can't develop to changing reality, then it tends to die away, because it becomes atrophied. It has nothing to nourish it. And I liked your description, the industrial. Because these religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, the monotheisms, all developed in a nascent market economy. And in cities, when religion had to change yet again. Frankly, religions have got to develop, and it's very hard when people find themselves displaced as industrialism encroaches. But you know, it's only the monotheisms that have been unable to accommodate other forms of faith. And even then, Western Christianity was by far the most intolerant until the 20th century. In Hinduism, you can be religious in any way at all, and you could always absorb a new deity into your pantheon, because none of the gods of our conception of God can reach out to the Brahman, to the ultimate reality which lies beyond speech.
I know that you have a great respect for and a great love of sacred texts, but I wonder if you can talk about how you approach using them to try and enhance your own understanding of what God is and how we humans have understood God.
Well, you have to wrestle with them. I like the story of Jacob wrestling with an angel and all night long. And at the end, the angel refuses to speak its name. And it's certainly a divine manifestation, but of course, silence, refusing to name itself, but blesses them. So we get moments, I think, of insight. And sacred texts are something that you work with. Scripture is an activity. It's not something you just read and swallow gullibly. It is a religious activity that is hard work, and you have to be selective in them because they are the Bible, particularly, is a library of sacred texts written over a millennium, and they have been careful to include all rival points of view. There's not a single message in the Bible. And I love studying these texts in a kind of scholarly way, in which a lot of people imagine would be stultifying, in finding out when these texts came to be written. What were the authors like? What were they thinking? Why did they bring this particular message to the table? Is it a good message? How is this other author responding to this particular strain? So that you see, have a great sense of human striving and struggling with these difficult notions. And I get caught up in that myself. And I think, above all, though, we, especially perhaps in the Christian world, we have a choice now. We can either emphasize those aspects of our tradition, and this goes for Muslims as well, which speak of, which have a violent intolerance strain, and we've all got these messages in our scripture, or we can emphasize those that speak of compassion. We can have, say, the Book of Revelation or the Sermon on the Mount, or try to make, as great Rabbi Hillel said, the whole of scripture a commentary on the golden rule: don't do to others what you wouldn't like them to do to you. And St. Augustine said the same. He said, if a scriptural text seems to preach hatred, you must work at it, allegorize it, and make it speak of charity. And that is a kind of dress rehearsal for the far more difficult task of finding a compassionate interpretation of events in real life, in your daily life.
Karen Armstrong is with us. Her new book is called The Case for God. We will go next to Glenn in Fort Worth. Hi, Glenn.
Hello.
Hi, Glenn.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call, and
sure,
thanks for this discussion. I'm both a scientist and a believer, that is, I'm a practicing Christian, and background in engineering, so I appreciate the scientific method. And but something I've noticed in our culture today is it seems like the discussions about God are so polarized. That is to say, people in the scientific community and non-believers are unwilling to step forward and talk openly and honestly and about perhaps thoughts that they have about the existence of God. That is, you know, an astrophysicist sitting on the edge of the north rim of the Grand Canyon pondering the existence of God. And it seems like people on the religious fundamentalists tend to be unwilling to talk about their doubts about the literal translations of the text. And I just wondered if you could comment on what other reasons and on those reasons that I've just given, it seems to be causing a lack of an intelligent discussion in our culture.
I couldn't agree more, Glenn. Thank you for bringing this up. Because people have usually imagined that science and religion have always been at daggers drawn, that the two are utterly incompatible. And in fact, they're not. They're just doing different jobs. They have different spheres of competence. A scientist can tell us about the world, but I don't know if you'd agree, Glenn, but science can't help us to find meaning if our child dies, for example. For that, we need the more intuitive disciplines of religion here. But it's dangerous to mix the two up, as happened when the theologians started to swallow the scientific proofs for God's existence. But we need each other. And I think that if we seal each other off, so that scientists and religious people sort of exclude one another from the conversation that they're having with themselves, then we're in a sort of schizophrenic situation and non-holistic. I think religious people, I'm not a scientist, Glenn, so you would have to tell me how scientists can sort of reach out to religion. But I think religious people should be inspired by modern science. And I don't know if you saw my article in the Wall Street Journal recently where Richard Dawkins and I sort of went head to head. And I think we could find a meditation, you see, in the natural selection. We see the terrible sorrow, horrible, unbearable picture of all these species perishing for eons. A natural history of pain was discovered, and it blew the idea of a nice, tidy, divine plan. But if we look at this, it resembles a meditation on the first noble truth of Buddhism: existence is suffering. It helps us to come to terms with the pain that lies at the heart of all human existence, an uncomfortable truth that we try to push away, but it is indispensable to enlightenment. We can't be compassionate if we don't recognize pain and its ubiquity and omnipresence. So I think we should embrace each other, scientists, and this rift is unnecessary. It developed only seriously in the late 19th century. Up until that point, there were a few blips like the Galileo disaster. But up until that point, religion and science, not surprisingly, has started to pull apart. Because we developed our rational powers so acutely that and science achieved such spectacular results that mythos became discredited. So that now, instead of meaning as it used to mean, myth, a timeless truth, something that in some sense had happened once, but which also happened all the time and helps you to deal with the pain and sorrow of life and gives you intimations of the transcendence we call God. Myth means something that isn't true. A politician, if accused of a peccadillo in his past life, is likely to say, oh, it's a myth, i.e. it didn't happen. And this has made religion very difficult for us, and we're frightened of each other. We shouldn't be. And it's also true, of course, that scientists feel threatened by religious people who try to sort of close down. I know I'm speaking in the Bible Belt here. You know, people are alarmed by the teaching of evolution and try to block it off. And so scientists get angry about that. I think we really need just to simmer down on all sides and learn to accommodate each other and live a whole life where there isn't this senseless, fruitless, and ultimately destructive antagonism.
Karen Armstrong is my guest this hour. Her newest book is called The Case for God. We'll be back to the discussion in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Karen Armstrong, whose newest book is called The Case for God. Karen, you have described people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, who are sort of the best known arguers today for atheism, that they are operating under a concept of God that is equally simplistic with some of the people that you think need to expand, who are still believing, who need to expand their vision of God?
Well, they are reacting mostly. They are preoccupied with fundamentalist religion, so-called. I don't like that word fundamentalist. I think it works well for Christian fundamentalists, but it's not so good when you apply it to Jews, Muslims, etc. But they are answering that fundamentalist challenge, especially Dawkins, who's enraged that the fundamentalists are trying to prevent the teaching of evolution, and he's a great evolutionary scientist and Darwinian. But they make a mistake in saying that this all religion is fundamentalist. That is their view. And their discourse is shaped by the fundamentalist critique, obviously, because that is what they're answering. And that has limited their critique very much because, of course, fundamentalism is just one very recent development in the religious traditions, which are multifarious, hugely complex. And so very often their remarks are simplistic. There's also an aggression there. I don't mind what people believe, really, or don't believe. But when Dawkins and Hitchens and Sam Harris say they want to expunge faith from human consciousness and see themselves in the vanguard of a movement that will exterminate faith, I don't think we can talk after the horrors of the 20th century of exterminating anything. And I think also it's counterproductive because my study of fundamentalist religion in Judaism, Christianity and Islam shows that when these movements are attacked, they become more extreme. And so I know for a fact that these Dawkins attacks have made for the first time evolution a problem in the Muslim world. Up until very recently, most Muslims had absolutely no problem with Darwin at all. The Quran doesn't say how God created the world. And every statement of the Quran is called an ayah, a parable, an allegory. Because we can only talk about these things, mysterious things, in terms of signs and symbols. So, you know, Darwin, they had no problem with. But every night I get, websites thrust on my computer screen, and suddenly I started having headlines, British atheist attacks Allah's creation. And so now there's a whole ferment about evolution that's grown up where it wasn't before because of that attack. So I think that very often fundamentalists have a limited view of secularism or liberalism. And Dawkins and Hitchens have a very simplistic and bigoted view of religion. I mean, Dawkins would see someone like me as responsible for Osama bin Laden, because what I'm doing is making respectable a way of life and a religious way of thinking and being and doing that ought to be wiped out.
Do you even think it's possible, if Richard Dawkins could sort of inculcate every child born in the world for the first 10 years of their lives, would it be possible to extinguish the need and the desire of human beings to believe in God? Many human beings, I'll say.
Well, I don't approve of that kind of indoctrination, really, and neither does Dawkins, actually. I mean,
but you understand my point.
Yeah, I do. I think we are wired for transcendence. We naturally, as a species, have ideas and concepts and experiences that go beyond what our conceptual grasp. We've created works of art that help us to cultivate this, and religions, which are closely allied with art too, to help us to do that. And it used to be thought in the middle of the 20th century that secularism was the coming ideology, and that religion would never again play a major role in world events. Well, we got that wrong. Religion is making a comeback. Now, religion is difficult to do, and not all religion is good. It's very difficult to fall flat on your face if you forget the compassionate ethos and the compassionate ideal, and use religion to back up your own fears and loathings of other people. I think the desire to live in relation to some form of transcendence, whether you call that God, Brahman, Nirvana, sacred, that is a peculiar characteristic of the human mind. It could be the defining human quality.
Let's go next on the phones to Mike in Carrollton. Hello, Mike.
Yes, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Well, I've got a question for Karen. I just want to let her know that she is one of my mentors, along with Muhammad, Jesus, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and now Obama.
Thank you very much. That's a very daunting list and a very flattering one to be included with. But God bless you, Mike.
You have turned me around. Muhammad, a long time ago, was a divine figure to many Muslims. But you turn around. I read that book, Muhammad, written by you.
Yes.
And I have given many copies to the people. You need to understand him as a man that you can relate with. And since then, you have turned me around. That singular book I read has a great impact on my life, and I want to appreciate that. And we were talking about the evolution and creation. I have a few comments there.
Let me just, Mike, I need to move you along a little bit quickly. I know you did have a question to get to. Would you mind going straight to that, please?
Yes. The will of God. What is the will of God? I believe the will of God is for his creation to coexist in harmony.
Yes.
And I believe if you look at all the religions, all of them is a removal of arrogance, bring humility so we all can be on par. So is that the will of God you see in all religious the essence of all religion?
Yes, I do. As the Quran says, O people, we have, and this is God speaking to the humanity, O people, we have formed you into tribes and nations so that you may get to know one another. Not so that you may conquer or dispossess or convert, but so that you may get to know one another. And the Quran says to Muhammad at one point, Muhammad, if we, God, had wanted to create, to make all humanity join one single religious community or ummah, we would have arranged it that way. But this was not our desire. pluralism and respect for other people's faith is part of the will of God. You certainly have this in Buddhism. You certainly have it in Hinduism, where all these multifarious gods are ways, simply ways of expressing the inexpressible divine that lies beyond them. In the Taoists would say that, you know, any kind of enmity is impeding our progress because it's ego, it's group egotism. And what the faiths all tell us is that it's not sufficient to have compassion for your own kind. You must have what one of the Chinese sages called yan ai, concern for everybody. Love the stranger, says the God in Leviticus. Honor the stranger who lives among you. Love your neighbor as yourself. And of course, in our global world, we're all neighbors. Love your enemies, said Jesus. That is, put your benevolence where there is no hope of getting any return. And love in Leviticus, when Jesus is quoting Leviticus when he says, love your enemies. It was a legal term. It didn't mean that we had to be filled necessarily with emotional tenderness. Feelings come and go. But in the ancient Middle East, kings would promise in international treaties to love each other. And that didn't mean they had to fall into each other's arms, but that they would promise to look out for each other's best interests, to be loyal to each other, to come to each other's aid. And I think, sadly, that what we're hearing today so much is the strident voice of intolerance in religion. Those are the ones that hit the airwaves. Those are the ones that hit the headlines. And yet, with this ethos, religious people should be making a major contribution to one of the huge tasks of our time, which is to build a global community where people of all persuasions can live together in peace and harmony. And any ideology that spreads hatred, as we're in this very, very dangerous place at the moment, is failing the test of the time if it preaches hate and division.
If you've come to a place in your life where you cannot define God and have sort of given yourself permission not to try, what's the value of prayer in your life?
Oh, well, for me, my study is my prayer. I was never, even as a young nun, good at praying, at talking to God, though I know other people do it wonderfully. But I could never do it.
Did you feel like a bad nun?
Hopeless. I would go in to try and make my meditation in the morning, and I can concentrate at my desk for hours at a time. But as soon as I knelt down to make my meditation, my mind would go skittering out down a whole ray of distractions and anxieties, worries, fantasies. I could not do it. And I felt a sinking sense of despair and failure all the time. But now, when I'm studying these texts, immersed in them, really wrestling with them, I will get moments of awe and delight, just mini seconds of it. And my Jewish colleagues tell me this is a very Jewish form of prayer. This is what Jews have when they study Torah and Talmud. They don't talk to God necessarily in the same way as, say, Christians do. But they will get these glimmers of transcendence. And similarly, I now know that monks in monasteries for centuries and still do practice what they call divine study, where they will read scripture in a ruminative way and suddenly it comes alight. So that is my prayer. But ordinary prayer, I think the way I would think about ordinary prayer, you know, for people who are able to talk to God, is that it's helping us to use language differently. Because, you know, we use language so often to protect ourselves, to surround ourselves with a kind of cautionary barricade against attack. So it's very rare for us to praise people wholeheartedly, because there's a sneaking little suspicion that, you know, we should be praised or they're not as good as us. I mean, my favourite one was, oh, Karen, you know, congratulations on your wonderful reviews, as a friend said. Have you put on weight recently? I immediately wanted to take you down in some way. Or it's also very sort of common when we don't apologize fully. When we say, I'm terribly sorry, we also get it in that the other person was also at fault. Nor do we express our extreme need and terror, because it's tough out there and you can't afford to show weakness. Now, in prayer, you can lay that aside. In prayer, you can thank wholeheartedly. You can praise wholeheartedly without fear of a comeback. You can express your extreme need and sorrow. And that is helping us to break down those barricades in ordinary life so that we let other people in and let God in.
I think we all know people, whether they are practicing believers or not, who manage to go through their lives without giving any of this very much thought. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what they're missing?
Well, religion is hard work. And, you know, it's like dancing or playing the piano. I really regret now, because I had piano lessons as a child. I didn't like it much and I never didn't practice properly. And I really regret that now. Because I could strum along, but I love music now. And, you know, I think, gosh, I would never be able to play like Vladimir Ashkenazy, but heavens, would I be able to appreciate music more if I'd studied more. I also regret not really learning, working hard enough at languages when I was at school. I can speak some languages, but in a mediocre way. If you don't work fully at religion, really agonizing. Religion is meant to make you confront things, not run away from them. It's meant to make you face up to the sorrow we see all around us, to our own death, to our deepest fears and anxieties. And it's an everyday compassion, the ability to put ourselves in the position of the other, to look into our own hearts, discover what gives us pain, and then refuse under any circumstance whatsoever to inflict that pain on anybody else. This is hugely hard work. And it's required of us, as Confucius said, all day and every day. Not just doing, oh, that's my good deed for the day. And then we go back to our ordinary, mediocre sort of lives of conflict and rivalry. But that you're missing an enhanced humanity. Just as a dancer who really practices and exercises develops capacities of body that are absolutely impossible for an untrained person.
Karen Armstrong's latest book is called The Case for God. Karen, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being here.
It's been wonderful. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.